Do you like music?
It's rich, it's alive, it's vivid. Stereophonic sound.
Are you fed up with constantly searching for the records you want?
Fame, fortune, platinum records. It's every boy's dream.
Every one of my records means something. The label, the producer, the year it was made.
I'm teaching you about rock music.
Seriously, you're totally elitist. You feel like the unappreciated scholars.
Okay, let's spin a disc.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Cut by Cut. This is episode 41, or season 4, episode 2, and we are taking it back to basics, going back and looking at an album, song by song, pulling it apart, talking about what makes it or fails to make it work, and we're doing Paul's Boutique, the album that confirmed that the Beastie Boys were not just sort of a one-hit wonder band or a group of lucky rapscallions set forth across the land with wiffle ball bats and Slayer guitar licks. That's right, proof positive that Russell Simmons and Rick Rubin didn't create some kind of weird, freakish New York supergroup of kids and set them onto America as lowbrow frat rap hip-hop kids. Is that about right? Chris?
Yeah, how's it going?
How are you, man?
I'm here. I just have fun hanging out in the background. So
yeah, well, you know, this is Idris Muhammad's Lauren's Dance from 1974, and I'm committing the cardinal sin of moving in my chair. Something that I would
should have known better. By
wag
now.
My finger at you if I was you were doing it
as I sit motionless.
That's right.
Not even my lips are moving.
That's because I've poisoned you. That's right. Pretty soon I'll be burying your body out by the septic tank. Why not in the septic tank? That's the fifth place cops look. How do I know this? Watch a lot of CSI.
Hidden in plain sight.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm just going to prop you in the corner.
Just stand me right behind the statue, the cutout of your father over here.
Yeah, that's a weird thing to say because the listeners have no idea what that means.
And I'm not going to tell them either.
We're coming at you on cutbycut.com. And, of course, through the soundless void of outer space at radiomutation.com. And we're opening this up. This is to all the girls, right? We're going to be talking about what is essentially an impossibly small song with almost no lyrics, but yet all of them somehow offensive. Certainly, the minute and 29 of this song, or the minute and 26 of this song.
That's audible?
That's audible. So yeah, so a song that by all standards in 2018 is completely and totally offensive, I would say, to most people. And I think it's proof positive, or I think it's the first one of the big things that, you know, when the Beasties for a while didn't want to talk about Paul's Boutique, I think that this is right out the gate, right? I mean, what they do from here to check your head when they start to introduce Buddhist and Zen chants.
Yeah.
And they talk about, you know, I don't smoke weed because it's like cutting off your nose to spite your face. Creativity, you know, creativity. Why is that not the right word? I'm having a seizure of some kind. So let's try to unpack this, shall we?
Okay.
Let's look first at the song as a whole. Okay, so it kicks in, like any song does, at 0 seconds, and it goes on for a while in almost complete silence.
Yeah, so as we wait for the silence to become less silent, when you gave me the CD to start researching, you know, listening to the music to prepare, I put it in, and I saw the timer moving, and I didn't hear anything, and I'm like turning up the dial on the radio, going, what the hell? There's mumbling. I hear mumble. I think I heard something. I turned it up more, you know. And I had the thing at full volume, and it's here it comes. Like this is what you get.
Yeah.
And I was like, is this right? Is this what he wants to do?
This was 100% intentional.
Yeah, yeah. I'm
sure it was. The idea being that by the time the song breaks into Shake Your Rump, it would blow your speakers.
Yes, well, it hurt me and my children.
So, well, we'll unpack that in a second. You listened to this with your children?
I started it and very quickly turned it off. Yeah. I was like, nope, this is for when I'm alone in the car.
This is for daddy's drive time.
I believe it was when I made it all the way to the, what is that sound, daddy? Next song, which we'll get to.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure what that sound is, honey.
Well, it certainly sounds like there's water leaking. Yeah, so to the Brooklyn girls, to the French girls, to all the Oriental girls, Chinese, Japanese.
Yeah, we can't say that anymore, right?
No, well, we don't because Oriental is...
What?
Because Oriental is... It's a term, right? I used to have an Asian friend.
It's a rug.
Yeah, it's a rug or a lamp, right? Yep. It's not a people.
Right.
And it comes from the time when people
used... I stole that from a show. I don't know which one.
Oh, I stole it from my friend Corinne.
Okay.
When I was like an 10th grade.
I have no idea what show it is, but to give credit to it, the line is something about Orientals.
Yeah, exactly what I just said.
I'm not a rug.
Yeah.
I'm a person.
Yeah, she used to get... I mean, with obviously very real... reasoning, she used to get furious when people would say that rather than Asian or Korean. It has to do with when maps used to be oriented. And so that became sort of the catch-all for, what am I looking for? Bigots?
What am I looking for?
Yes.
Hypocrites?
And so, you know, it's funny because I found this one thing online where somebody was trying to defend it. Right. And you know what? Like, just say we did it. It was stupid. Let's move on. Right. Like, but someone tries to defend it here by saying they used the term as a hint that they knew whole concept of giving a shout out to literally all the girls is like, kind of ridiculous. So in this ridiculousness,
I thought we were defending people who historically said Oriental. You're talking about it defends. You're telling me that Beastie Boys did it? They're defending the Beastie Boys?
They're defending the Beastie Boys. Like, no. The idea that, look, this is just for fun. Don't take this seriously. And I think the whole rest of the song sums that up perfectly, right? So, like, you got Brooklyn girls, you got French girls, you've got Chinese girls, you've got Japanese girls, you've got Swiss girls, you've got Italian women. So suddenly there's a shift in age here to the Upper East Side nubiles. And why I say that there is a definite shift in age, why Italian women over Swiss girls, I'm not quite sure. But the next thing obviously is to Upper East Side nubiles, right? The idea that these are young women who are now suitable for marriage.
Okay.
So we don't want that. If you're going Italian, you want an Italian woman.
Okay.
Like she will wreck your world, right? Then the Jamaican girls, and then topless dancers.
Topless dancers. And then doesn't even quantify.
Who apparently are their own ethnicity or race, right? Which is a really strange thing.
I'd like to see a Venn diagram somehow.
Right, all of the girls that get shouted out.
Well, the song is to all the girls, so there's a Venn diagram.
Yep.
Thing. Yeah. Are women inside the circle with girls?
Mm-mm.
So they're
that's a separate circle.
So it's just Italian women. So you've got a Venn, two non-intersecting Venns.
Yep.
Of women and girls.
Yep.
And then inside,
dude,
women.
You've already lost me.
Inside
your science. Your science proves nothing.
The cover art for this episode will be a Venn.
So then we get to all the Jamaican girls and the topless dancers, Australian and Brazilian. So are those Australian and Brazilian topless dancers?
So let me. So this is semantics as the resident
English speaking guy.
English,
yeah, I'm with you on this one.
Literate person. Well, I would say yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say to all the topless dancers, Australian and Brazilian. So the other ones, they're not shouting out to. So if you're let's say a Dutch topless dancer.
No, you're not.
You're not included in this.
Go
right.
Away. Go away.
If you are an Inuit topless dancer, you're not.
If you're the Inuit.
Yeah, exactly. Frosty Peaks. What would you call that strip club if you were to put one in Alaska? I don't know. Northern Canada's only strip club.
Well, I don't know.
I think Frosty Peaks, you know, it would have kind of like a David Lynch tinge to it, right? She'd come out.
I can't even get my shit together now.
I'm doing this, man. So she'd come out like with a big beard, like Paul Bunyan, and like maybe she has another dancer sharing the stage with her who's dressed like Babe the Blue Ox.
Oh.
And the two of them start to like rhythmically go at it, and all of a sudden like the beard comes off, the horns come off.
So speaking of people, total just left turn I'm taking right now.
Oh, really? Because I hadn't taken one already?
Have you seen Tusk?
No, I don't want to digress this with Kevin Smith shit. I really don't.
Okay.
I don't. I vow to the people on this podcast
don't watch
right
it.
Now. No. Kevin Smith will never be brought up again.
Oh, okay.
He may be a super swell guy. No.
Then belay my last.
Yeah,
concern.
And I don't want to sully the Beastie Boys with.
Enough said.
You take that back.
I have visually, folks. I think this is the closest I've ever come to upsetting.
Yeah. No. My stomach is churning. So anyway,
we move on. New Biles
to the Southern Belles, the Puerto Rican girls, to the stewardesses, flying around the world.
So are those just people doing the circumference flight of the world?
Yeah, if it's a only transatlantic flights,
right?
Yeah, any kind of domestic flight, any kind of like, you know, just real quick jump. No time for
North Carolina to Atlanta.
No, because that's not enough time to get in the Mile High Club, right? I would assume if you're going to do the Mile High Club with a stewardess, then or an air hostess, we'll update it. one would need to. You'd have to be an amazing player to get on if a Beastie Boy gets on a plane in New York, traveling at 800 miles an hour.
And Madonna gets on one.
And the average air hostess takes half an hour to break down before considering Mile High Club with said Beastie Boy. How fast does that Beastie Boy have to be flirting before he's in a completely unsanitary bathroom?
The answer is 12 parsecs.
Wow. Really? Okay. So he has to be the same kind of... Do you think any of the Beasties at this point were Han Solo worthy?
I mean
you brought it up with parsecs, so 80, don't...
Early 90s, late 80s, style-wise?
Yeah, and which Beastie would have shot first? Anyway...
I mean, we're talking Paul's Boutique era here, so they were probably in their version of... their personalized pimp attire that they raided out of the closet we mentioned in the previous episode, right?
Yep.
So they've got it's almost the 90s, so that the 80s, like, vibrant colors is out. They're back down into, like, well, they're in some animal fur, right, with probably...
Yeah, but even by the 89 standard, that was pretty ostentatious. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean... I always have problems when people talk about, like, and not you in particular, but like when people talk about like the transition between like the 60s into the 70s,
sure.
It's not like a light went on and suddenly people were, you know, like when you watch films like Boogie Nights, which is a great film, but Boogie Nights, and then there's a whole litany of these ones. What's the Goodfellas, right?
Yeah.
It's like a party in 1979
and
someone walks up to the main character and goes, hey, have you ever tried cocaine? And then they sniff cocaine and like, wow, cocaine's awesome.
And suddenly it's
God, it's 1980s. Screw these clothes. And all of a sudden it's like 1984. You know, like it takes a while for things to morph and to die down. But I think you bring up a great point though. I think what makes the Beasties so ridiculous is there was nothing like this in hip hop at that time.
Yeah.
This is totally a piss take. This is three guys screwing with the audience and screwing with the record company. Could you imagine being the record exec and hearing what is basically a blaxploitation introduction to this album? I mean,
yeah.
So even look at like...
You're right. So it's kind of got like a Shaft type intro.
Right, exactly.
Or, yeah, yeah.
And so you're hearkening back to a zeitgeist, you're hearkening back to a time where there isn't that same. I mean, now we're steeped in nostalgia, right? Everything is nostalgia, and you can't be, you know, you dress in 1960s stuff, and people are like, "Cool, dude, you know." There wasn't any of that in the 70s into the 80s.
So we're basically calling these guys like these are they're kids still.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They just got handed three,
more money than God.
$3 million.
Yeah,
and their life is a party. And they're basically, and they just came off of a contentious relationship with their former, you know, the people who helped launch them.
Yep.
And so they're kind of, they're in this mode where it's like, we've got nothing to lose, right? We already almost lost, but we just won again. We're back in the saddle here. And
now we're doing it our way 100%.
Yeah, this is where money makes you. Money helped make them, you know, magnify whatever capacity they had for douchebaggery here.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all out now.
And this is, I mean, to me, I'm going to play the music underneath a little bit here, but this to me is almost like coming out of the drug haze of License to Ill, right? So if we're looking at License to Ill as a frat rock party album.
Sure.
This is the next morning when you're waking up and kind of everything is slowly, the lights are slowly coming on. You're finally sobering up a little bit. This is the morning after soundtrack right here. No, I'm serious.
Yeah, sure.
It's coming out of that weed haze, right? It's coming out of that. And so after the dust has settled and after all the money is cleared and everything's going, what do you have left, right?
So I'll sound a little I should have been prepared for this, but what album was that song Girls on?
License to Ill.
Oh, it was License. Okay, yeah. I thought so, but I didn't have it in front of me. So I guess I'm going to parallel that song with this song.
Yeah, of course.
So they're, I guess, offensive in their own unique ways. But so this isn't a new level of
no, but this is out. This
immature,
is like I said,
immaturity, I'll say.
But like I said, this is that morning after. So right, so girls in the morning, it's girls, because in the evening it's girls. Yeah, all I want is girls. You know, I like the way that they walk. I like the way that they talk.
And with this, and the way they do the dishes.
With this really infantile sort of beat behind it.
Yeah.
Right? Like you listen to the song Girls. Hold on a second as I pull it up here. And it's like,
yeah.
It's elementary school shit, right? Yeah. This is ridiculousness. Girls. And so but like I said, so after you've slept with all of these girls, right? After you've slept your way around America and the world on tour,
yep.
Right? They'd toured for what? Almost 2 years nonstop. So that they were like exhausted. They were tired of each other. They were tired of the industry. You know, they just kind of wanted to make music again. And here you have a record company saying, you need a follow-up. You have to have a follow-up. We want you back in the studio. Def Jam's like, we want you back in the studio. We want you doing this stuff. And they're like, no, we need a vacation is what we need.
Sure.
We need, you know, 6 months off to do nothing. And they took it. And I hold true when I say that the opening, you know, to all the girls is this like, hey, ladies, thanks a lot. We'll be back in a second. And there is no sonic break between this and Shake Your Rump.
Right. Yeah. The beat goes.
Yeah. And I don't want to go in. This is dangerously close to going into Shake Your Rump, but it's almost impossible to talk about these two songs as separate entities, because what you get in the last four, what you get in the last 5 seconds here is. So, you know, this is that wake up, like, girls, we'll be back in a second. We just need a minute to relax. And then all of a sudden, like, they come back in this massive explosion, which we'll talk about in the next episode more keenly. But, I mean, again, I think that answers pretty solidly with, why do you start an album with a slow jam? Nobody starts an album with a slow jam. You know, it'd be like if the first song off of like the Beatles' Revolver was Eleanor Rigby.
So I look at it, and I'm this all could have been, if this was just one track, I wouldn't even think twice about it.
Oh, you mean like to all the girls into Shake Your Rump?
Like if it was one of those like intro slash Shake Your Rump.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like plenty of people do that, right? They have a kind of funky little intro. Doesn't deserve to be its own track. You know,
yeah, like this. Totally.
I've never seen them live. Never even watched a live video of Beastie Boys, but I would imagine they don't play to all the girls. Maybe they come out to it. Maybe one at a time they'd walk out on. I can only imagine what they would have done with it.
Right, right.
Maybe it's just playing while people are milling around, waiting for them to come onto the stage or something.
There's not a lot of milling in a minute, 26 seconds.
Well, late. You know what I mean. Just yeah. They clearly had an instrumental version of this thing, like, so they might just be playing.
Yep.
On loop.
Yeah,
you know what
yeah.
I mean? I can see that's what I would do with it, you know, were I a beastie.
Sure.
But
one beastie you be, all alone without nobody. I love that the song is so simple, and the power of it really is this Idris Muhammad track. You know, and it's not even sampled. It's not even much hiding the sample. It's, you know, literally like the first couple seconds of the song, boom, right yep. there. You know, and the Dust Brothers know better, right? I mean, the samples that they choose throughout the album, possibly with the only exception when they sample later in the album, Susie is a Headbanger from the Ramones, nothing is obvious.
Yeah, it's just mishmashed all kind of together and with a beat kind of behind it all, right? And even the beat changes.
Yeah. And you take this beautiful 1974 jazz anthem. I mean, the album itself, the song itself was huge when it first came out. It was massive. It was like a chart topper on jazz radios in 1974. So it probably is one of the most, you know, not by today's standards, of course, but by the 1970s standards, it was a jam.
The Idris Muhammad's.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course,
How in tune are you with the jazz world?
I'm not. I had to do. I used as a resource this thing called Wikipedia.
What exactly is that all about?
It's basically an online encyclopedia, and it just knows everything, man. Like the most intelligent people in the world are just tuning in to help out, and it's really great. And so I wrote the definition for it. I wrote. You know, I.
They didn't have an entry for jazz yet? You filled it out?
I filled it in for jazz, yes. A music that's very popular on NPR.
popularized by programs on NPR.
I'm Soccer Jones, and you're going to be listening to the sound of slow jazz. Tonight's track, One Note Saxophone.
Why do we get the feeling this podcast is nothing more than a long audition for NPR?
I'm hoping to God, man. You know, like there's some holes in their catalog now. You know, now that like, you know, This American Life is going off guy and he's doing his own thing now. So I think, you know, getting back to really real quick to sum up this whole thing. Everything about this album defies what is commercially viable.
Yeah.
I mean, even the album cover, right, which is Lee's Sportswear, right? It's the fictional Paul's Boutique. They create the sort of concept of it being Paul's Boutique. And there's actually people who will say, like, no, I think Paul's Boutique existed. But again, through the research that I did into this, it was something else.
They took a picture. I don't even know if it was their original picture. They took it was a picture of a street corner boutique.
Jeremy Chatan. So they had this guy named Hayes, who was a pretty solid and pretty famous graffiti artist out of New York.
Right.
And he was supposed to do the album cover. So it would have had kind of this very sign of the times graph Beastie Boys image. And I don't know, I've never seen any idea of the completed image or anything like that. But they had it lined up. And At the last second, this kid, Jeremy Chatan, had a camera with a panoramic lens.
Ah.
And so they said, take a picture of this, will you? And so he did, and that became obviously the most infamous cover.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, it's like the Beatles' White Album. It doesn't say Paul's Boutique on it. It doesn't say Beastie Boys written across the top. You had to know
right
what you were looking for.
Yeah, interesting. So that probably has some, clearly, I mean, you get the feeling, well, they probably were pretty, again, they wanted to do it their way. So they wanted to be this nondescript thing.
Yeah, and so when you bought the cassette, even the cassette was marbled like a 1970s soul album.
Oh, okay.
You know, everything about it spoke Isaac Hayes. Everything about it spoke the Shaft soundtrack. Everything sure. about it was, this isn't a follow-up to the Beastie Boys.
Yeah, and
this
isn't enter them walking in with the fat gold ropes around their neck with a mink coat. And
yeah, right? And so my theory, I have this theory that License to Ill was just frat rock, right? It was three guys singing about how much sex they could have, how many drugs they could do, how much, you know, beer they could swill. And that was a real driving force, right? I mean, the number one hit off that was Fight for Your Right to Party. And I think that everything else on that album, as much as I love the album, goes to support that thought. This is a celebration of lowbrow culture. So when kids are like, well, what's the difference between trash and lowbrow? Lowbrow is, I'm smart enough to do highbrow stuff. I'm smart enough to do this level of creativity. But you know who I'm going to talk about? I'm going to talk about Cheech Wizard, you know, the guy who wrote these, like, you know, like adult comic books. I'm going to talk about Fred Flintstone. I'm going to talk about
the homeless guy on the corner.
Right. Rockabilly, and mention blue suede shoes. And so this minute pause between License to Ill and Paul's Boutique is just that. Yes, years have passed. But if you play these two albums back to back, there's just this come down moment. There's this kind of like, just give me a second, ladies, while I recharge. And then they explode into the rest of the album. And then the rest of the album is, it doesn't slow down.
Right.
I don't think there is a, we can argue about this, but I don't think there's a slow song on the album from here on out.
I think you have to, so just in preparing for what I've been preparing, you, to do this album all at once would be impossible. So, like, this is where I think a track by track, I'm justifying our existence, but this track by track, we can kind of slow it down, look at just the one track, right? And talk about it, because I don't think it doesn't. It's one long, I mean, crap, the last song, I think, is actually 15 songs in one or something like
yeah.
that, right?
Oh, it was crafted to be just, I think you're exactly right. You know, it was crafted to just be one big assault. And I think that that's, the Beasties were just unloading everything. Just, you know what I mean? Like, they were unloading a couple decades worth of all of this lowbrow, blaxploitation, disco, punk, rock and roll, you know, even Ricky Powell. Right, who's the photographer, he took a photograph, the famous insert photo of them pressed up against this sort of porthole in the swimming pool, right? That's not an image that people want to see. Like, it's an awesome image. It's really, really cool.
It's not one the record company would have taken of them, right?
Right, when you get the black and white headshot of the band, you know, and it's almost always like one guy looking like badass at the camera, somebody looking off to the other side, and somebody kind of like looking down at their, you know, it's always the same fucking photograph. And nobody does it more obnoxiously than punk bands, because they're all trying to be ironic, right? They're all like, oh, we're too cool for this. Just take the damn picture. If you got, could you imagine getting this green and orange blob of the three faces pressed up against a porthole and being like, how do I sell these kids?
Right.
We've made a huge mistake here at Capitol. I want to talk about this later on, because one of my all-time favorite bands in the world, The Clash, is, you know, had problems with Capitol as well.
Yep.
That Capitol's big thing was sort of bringing in all these bands and then just cutting them off. right? So like when Cap, when the Clash wanted to come to America, Capitol said no originally, right? They were like, that we don't hear a single, we don't hear a single on this album.
Yeah.
So when you start looking at Capitol Records sort of track record, they put out a lot of great stuff, but they also, you know, you know, basically almost missed a lot of great stuff too.
Well, I think too, like it helps the people that have, the people that recover, they don't let it, any good act's not going to let it stop them. Capitol didn't destroy the Clash.
Right.
Capitol didn't destroy the Beastie Boys. They put a roadblock up. Well, no. Capitol kind of actually came to their rescue in a way. I don't know how the rest of the...
Yeah, I mean, I see Capitol as the heroes of this story, at least as I've had it told to me or as I've read it in research and stuff like that. You know, yeah, Capitol bailed them out of Def Jam. They would never have gotten their money if it wasn't for
and
Capitol.
And I think, you know, classically, all of these companies with suits, you know, they some people see it, some people don't.
There's some guy named Darren, right, saying, like, well, I don't know if I can package this. and so that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be unpacking it. And thanks to Capitol Records, but more importantly, thanks to you for tuning in to episode 41 of Cut by Cut. I am Scapegoat Jones, and you're listening to
Scapegoat Jones.
You're listening to All the Girls, episode 42, here at cutbycut.com. Again, our shows drop on Tuesdays. Hey, if you like this show, would you kindly go to iTunes and leave a 5-star review and then say a couple kind words like, boy, I bet they sound like really handsome men. Whatever. It's an algorithm thing. It's honest to God, we don't ask for your money. Frankly, I wouldn't even know what to do with it. So it's because I have so little.
We'd probably just buy more copies of Paul's Boutique.
Yeah, we'd waste it on things like rent. So do us a favor and do that, and then more people will hear the show, hopefully, and that would be delightful.
Or I've got an idea I meant to mention last episode.
Okay.
But send us an email
hell.
We don't have a phone number. So no. I was going to say call us and leave us a message, but if you have any Paul's Boutique stories, favorite tracks, let us know, and we'll throw them into the front of an episode or something and share them with the rest of the listeners.
Or more importantly, you know, where were you when you first heard Paul's Boutique?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, that'd be, yeah, you know what? You guys pull some weight for a change. You know what? We're doing all the work here. You tell us what song is the best makeout song on this album. You tell us where you were when you first heard the album. What store did you shoplift it from?
Right.
You know, your favorite line. Yeah, any of the good. Thanks, Chris.
Yeah.
Nice, good job.
I'm going to go home now. I'm
done. And if you're listening, again, we are the only talk show on Radio Mutation for worse. And so.
So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Copper. And go listen to a lot of the other shows on there, which are pretty fantastic. But continue listening to us. And hell, even if you don't listen to us, just download us every week. All right. Bye.
See you next week.